Thank you for joining us today. We hope you enjoy this message. For more information about the Upper Room, please visit uroom.org.
This morning, I'm in a process with you, a few things that are happening, and then we're going to pray for a group of people, and then I may invite a friend up to come and minister a little bit more, because we're... we've had an interesting week. My wife is actually supposed to be preaching this morning. She was scheduled 2 weeks ago. She was going to finish up our series on the Word, 1-3-5. How many of you are doing 1-3-5? It's been so good. And I just, let me exhort some of you that are doing 1-3-5. I know the 5 for a month can be a lot. So if you want to do 1-3 and then 5 for 2 weeks, just as long as you're in the Bible, it's a good thing. And so to hear the testimonies, though, of people that are really getting into consistently the Word. It's one Proverbs a day, 3 Psalms a day, and then 5 chapters in the New Testament every day for 1 month, which is remarkable to hear how the Word is coming alive inside of people's hearts. So I just encourage you to continue to do that. Larissa was going to finish our series on the B-I-B-L-E, yes, that's the book for me. But we had a little issue at our house on Friday night. My 4-year-old started vomiting, which that's like kind of normal, I guess, for 4-year-olds to do it. But we haven't never had a kid with like a stomach bug where it's like every 15 minutes for like hours on end. Like, I had never seen a human being do that. And I was like, honey, we need to go to the hospital. And she's like, no, this is what a stomach bug is. And then last night, my 18-month-old woke up at 10:30, and so I took care of Freeland. I was in the bed, and every 15 minutes for about 5 hours, he was doing that. And then my 6-year-old woke up at 5 a.m. doing it, and then Larissa came in at about 8:45, and she said, honey, I can't go to church, and she got it. And so, yay, Millers! We're having a good weekend. I've got some plans today, but I just wanted to stand up in front of you and process this. I think it's important. I do. I think it's important to process sin. And oftentimes we grit our teeth just to get through it. And on the other side, Jesus is faithful. Sometimes in the midst of the day of trouble, how we process the day of trouble is really, really important. The most common phrase that sticks out to me in the Psalms is in the day of trouble. In the day of trouble. In the day of trouble. And as a pastor, I see a lot of people, I meet a lot of people in the day of trouble. And in the day of trouble, you see how they prepared in the previous days for that day. And honestly, many of you or many people, because of a day of trouble in the past, not properly processed, begins a life of disappointment. It's like you had that day of trouble and you didn't process it rightly, so you withheld, you started to make agreements and beliefs around that day of trouble, and you drag that into the rest of your life, and before you know it, your heart's just in fragments, and you're not really passionate and full of faith, and yes, I love God, and I believe in God, but, I don't know how good he is. Do you know what I'm saying? So, hey, I'm processing this morning. So if I start to say anything that you don't agree with, just go, he's processing. I know this week, I'm heavy-hearted because we have a dear brother in our family who has walked with the Smiths for a while, and Jeff and Laura Hastings, Michelle, I'm sorry, do they have a daughter named Laura? Okay, I'm processing, all right? But Jeff and Tracy Morris have been coming to the Upper Room for a while, but Jeff was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer last year, and he had a previous bout with cancer that went into remission, but it came back. And this week, Jeff went to be with Jesus. And we met, me and Jeff and Phil, we met in that cry room and came up with a plan. And We were attacking that, and it was just really sudden, actually, how it happened this week. But it's a day of trouble. It's a day of trouble, and trouble comes, right? Trouble is just—it's a part of this side of eternity. It's like, man, storms come, winds blow. It's not, you know, if the storm comes, it's when the storm comes. And some of you are right in the midst of a storm. And my hope in my heart this morning as I process with you, and again, I could process for 5 minutes. We could be here for 5 hours. I'm not sure, certain. I'm just kidding. That was a joke. Golly, 5 hours. But I want to process with you just how I have learned to guard my heart above all else. Because Jesus said in John 14, verse 1, he said, do not let your hearts be what? Trouble. So there's something about an outward commotion and an outward reality and not a letting that affect the inward reality of what you're carrying. But what I'm learning is that inwardly we are impacted and we are affected. And so what we do with our hearts in the midst of trouble determines the state of our heart after the trouble. And we have to, above all else, guard our hearts. And it means we have to be honest with ourselves. We have to be honest with questions we have, with feelings that we have. And we have to learn to position our hearts before the king of our hearts or the Lord of our hearts, or the one who dwells in our hearts, so he can shepherd our hearts through whatever valley, storm, trial we're walking through. Because though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, still you are with me. And what I feel like at times we do in the midst of trouble, us, you know, that have it all together, and us that trouble doesn't really affect me, or how are you doing? I'm doing fine. My kids are throwing up. My wife is throwing up. She's supposed to be preaching, but how are you doing, Mike? I'm doing fine. Really, how I'm doing great. We live that way. And yet inwardly, we're just suppressing and stuffing the reality of what we're facing. And we have to learn to process our hearts before him. It doesn't mean you have to get on a mic and have a counseling session with your church like I'm doing this morning, okay? And I can do that because of, you know, I'm just kidding. I'm not actually doing that, but I kind of am. But it does mean that you do have an audience with him where you can process what's happening internally with your heart and allow him to shepherd you through it. And what I feel like we do, especially in the charismatic, like faith, God can do anything, he's good, living from moment to moment, when a moment confronts us that isn't giving us goosebumps, chills, and lining our theology up, I feel like what we do is we run to the pat answers and we begin declaring certain things, or we get in this facade and this realm of just gritting our teeth, and yet we're not honest. We're not honest. And listen, love rejoices in the truth. And here's what I've learned about love is sometimes I used to think like love rejoices in capital T, truth, like big truth. Love rejoices in that. Need to be. But what I feel like love rejoices in is the truth, your truth. Whatever reality you are, love will rejoice that you are being truthful before the Lord. Now listen, it says love rejoices in truth, but it does not delight in evil. So even if it is evil, what you're being honest about, it doesn't delight in that, but it rejoices that you're being honest with what you're going through, so love can shepherd you through it. And what I'm learning is when we just have these pat answers, when we just have this is what I'm supposed to believe, this is what I'm supposed to say, this is what I'm supposed to agree with, what happens is that love, or the shepherd who meets us in the valley, his role is to take us to that truth. His role is to meet us in that day, in that moment, in our specific itemized, oh my God, I can't believe my kids throwing up, or my husband, my wife, whatever, he wants to come and meet us in that place. To meet us. And he wants to shepherd us. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you have the answer. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you're with me. And him being with us shepherds us through that, so that on the end of it, it's not just that we got through it, it's that we got through it with him, and we have a greater revelation and understanding of who he is in us and with us. And man, we can stand confidently and say, wow, you're really good.
Yes.
Are you following me? My days of trouble have actually set me up. I actually, when I look back, I give God glory for those moments of trouble. John the Baptist is a good example. I'm a preacher. I need to get in the Bible. Matthew 11, John the Baptist, it's something that you may be familiar with, but John the Baptist was like the great forerunner of Jesus, yes? Like, he was the man. He was the greatest of all Old Testament prophets, according to Jesus. Like in the Old Testament, he's the standard. And he's making the way, prepare the way of the Lord. I'm unworthy to tie his shoes. He baptized him. He saw the dove fall. He said, I must decrease, he must increase. Like John the Baptist knew the revelation of Christ greater than anyone in his day. And at the end of his ministry, he didn't end. Things didn't turn out the way that he thought they would turn out. He was in prison. And when he was in prison, his disciples were tending to him, but John sent his disciples with a question. Are y'all familiar with this story? Matthew 11. Matthew 11, he said, will you go and ask Jesus this one question? Ask him if he's the expected one. Go and ask him if he's the one. John's whole life, he didn't have a glass of wine, poor guy. He lived and ate locusts and camel skin. He lived knowing the answer to the question that he's asking at the end of his life. Think about it just for a second. Like, put yourself, empathy, it's such a big deal. Put yourself in John's shoes. He's in prison, and all of a sudden, discouragement. He's like getting disheartened. His things are being, I'm in prison. And so he sends his disciples. And do you know what Jesus says? Can you put it up, John? Matthew 11. Matthew 11. That was tongues. And if you knew the interpretation, is Matthew 11. Matthew 11, look, now it came to pass when Jesus finished commanding his 12 disciples that they departed to teach and preach in their cities. Verse 2. And when John had heard in prison the works of Christ, he sent two of his disciples. Verse 3, he said to them, are you the coming one, or do we look for another? Now Jesus actually answers John's question, not necessarily with, like, he could have pointed to theology, he could have pointed to a lot, but he pointed to him about what Jesus was actually doing. He said, go and tell him the things which you hear and which you see. And it was like, go and tell him this good news. Go and tell him, hey, this is what I'm doing in this moment. And there's a real spiritual principle, I think, about focusing not on what you're going through, but seeing what the Lord is doing and celebrating that. What I wanted to point out here, though, is, I believe, because we can see John the Baptist would be beheaded. That there would be a woman that would come in front of, I think it's Herod, whoever was king then. She would do a dance in front of him. He was so wowed. He said, what do you want? And the harlot, who hates the forerunner, tells her daughter, hey, have his head decapitated and bring it to me on a platter. And that would play out. Like, John's fate is not good. What's about to happen to him in the natural? Head is cut off on a platter. Here you go. Thanks for dancing for me. Like, it's a really demonic, twisted thing that's about to take place in John's life. It's very twisted, very demonic. But what, if you look, this is what's amazing, is that from Jesus' perspective, Jesus would be really grieved by it. Jesus would lament. He would get away. It was like probably one of the most troublesome days when he learns about John the Baptist beheading, because I think John the Baptist, Jesus were boys, and it was this connection that they had. But what I think is amazing about this story is in the book of Revelation, do you know that there's a special reward for those that are beheaded? Those that are beheaded are actually the closest to the Lord in proximity in the age to come. Is that profound? So Jesus, in the midst of seeing this temporal thing, a light and momentary affliction, which at, this does not seem like a light and momentary affliction because this guy's about to get his head cut off, but it would equate to a glory, a weighty glory for eternity that John is experiencing right now. Right now, he's experiencing the reward of what he went through. I guess my point is like seeing what we're going through from an eternal perspective, it like anchors us in his reality so that we can not allow what we're going through to like make our heart all crusty, nasty, and yuck. I'll go here, and then I want to pray for people, and then I think I'm going to bring my buddy up. Is anyone resonating, or is this just for me? Okay, good. You're like, I thought it was, but it feels really right to me. There's a number of stories we could look at biblically. Like, you've got John the Baptist here. I think you could look at Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. I think you look at writings of Paul, 11 out of the 12 disciples were martyred. Like, it's just, they went through, but a guy that a story that's really ministered to me in times like this is David, when David was at Ziklag, which is a story that a lot of people are probably familiar with, but it was Saul's cat and mouse game, Saul, David, and they come to Ziklag. And when they get to Ziklag, I believe it was the Amalekites, but there was an army that came and just destroyed where David's kids and wives were at. The men were all fighting, about 600 men. And they come back and they're like, man, our wives are gone, our property's gone, our livestock's gone. And they were really, really, really disheartened to the point it says that they had no strength. It actually says that in there, that they were to the point where David had no strength, and the people had no strength. And not only were they so disheartened that they were gone, they then said, hey, we're just going to kill David. Let's stone him. They were plotting to kill the leader that they had been following. And so in 1 Samuel chapter 30, I'll read it. Verse 3, it says, when David and his men came to the city, behold, it was burned with fire. Their wives and their sons and their daughters had been taken captive. Then David and the people were with him. They lifted their voice and they wept. So they're weeping, they're mourning until they literally had no strength in them. Now David's two wives had been taken, that girl and Abigail. And in verse 6, it says, moreover, David was greatly distressed because the people spoke of stoning him. So it's just not, this would be defined as a day of trouble, yeah? 24 hours. And for all the people were embittered, they were angry. This is a deep sense of hatred, anger, oh my God, in their soul. Each one because his sons and daughters were gone. And so David, though, strengthened himself in the Lord. It's a powerful text about knowing how to do this in the day of trouble. Knowing how to strengthen yourself in the day of trouble. Knowing how to position your heart before the Lord in the day of trouble. Psalms 24, 7, verse 4, David actually writes about the day of trouble. And this wasn't specifically to this account, but I want to just make mention of it because I think it's in 27, verse 5, actually, it says, for in the day of trouble, he will conceal me in his tabernacle. In the secret place of his tent, he will hide me. He will lift me up on a rock. And now my head will be lifted above my enemies around me. He offers sacrifices with shouts of joy and sings yes to the Lord. So you see David throughout the psalm, day of trouble, day of trouble, day of trouble. But it always has him positioning his heart before the one who is his defender, shield, protector, caretaker, the one that can like cover him in that moment, I think it is the secret sauce of David's life. And here it's showing up that like, okay, I got to get to that place. He gets that place, he finds strength, and then because he found strength in the Lord, he puts his ephod on, which we won't get into the ephod, but the ephod's a bad man, majamba, when you look into what the ephod means and what he does. In verse 8, David inquired of the Lord, so that he prays the Lord. He positions himself where he can hear. He positions where he says, well, shall I pursue this band? Not like a rock band, but a band of people that took over. Shall I overtake them? And the Lord says, yes, pursue. You will surely overtake them. You will surely rescue all. And so in verse 9, this is what I wanted to show you. So David went, and look at what he did. He and the 600 men who were with him, he took them from that place. The leader comes forth, and I think this is what Jesus does to us. Look at Jesus as David in this scenario, and we're following Jesus in the day of trouble, okay? Because he takes the army, he takes them to the brook of Bezor. Everyone say the brook of Bezor. Now that doesn't mean much, like, okay, that's cool. But it's important because it's in the Bible and everything in here is important. And a while back, I was like looking at what does Bezor mean? Why the brook of Bezor? Why is that in there? Well, Bezor in the Hebrew, it means joy or cheerful. And then the epitomology, if you go into the root of the word, it actually means good news. Shouts of joy right there. Just freaking getting blasted. I love that. So the brook of Bezor is, listen, it's water. Water represents what? Water represents the Spirit of God. They have to cross this brook of good cheer and this brook of good news. And here they are. And look at this. It says that he and 400 men crossed the brook, but 200 were too exhausted to cross the brook and they remained behind. So only 2/3 made it through that brook. But I think in the day of trouble, you have to come to that brook where you get strength. And what is your strength? Your strength is the joy, cheer of the Lord. And so you find a strength in the day of trouble that's outside of yourself and outside of your circumstances, that's only found by you positioning yourself before the one who can deliver you in the day of trouble. All right, does this make sense? But most of us, we're so shut off because of what we're going through that we haven't learned to set aside some of the fear, the doubt, the unbelief, to position ourselves before the Lord in such a way that he can come, refresh, touch our hearts so that those things can be flushed out and we can actually like, oh, there you are. I see you, bro. All right. If it's just for you, me and you. I remember, I'll share this testimony and then I want to pray for people, but I remember, man, you get into healing, start praying for healing, you got to know how to do this. Because it can be very disheartening praying for, we like have a house where we believe that Jesus heals and heals supernaturally. We hear testimonies all the time. We have evangelists that are here and I just hear stories. We heard of all the stuff happening at Power and Love. How many of you went to Power and Love this week? I was just eating from a lot of those stories. Robbie Dawkins, who I think I'm going to bring up here in just a second, he spoke there and was just listening to testimonies about what the Lord had done at Power and Love. And then here's my entire household vomiting, right? I mean, we've got every pan is have some type of, it's just, it's not pretty at my house, all right? And so I'm like trying to reconcile what I've heard and what we believe, what I've heard and what we're like. There's this tension here. Are you following me? And so I was a Church of Christ guy. Y'all know that. And I love the Churches of Christ. But like healing and And that tradition and healing in the sense of what I believe now didn't go hand in hand, but we were at a church that was experiencing like an outpouring of God at this Church of Christ where we were seeing a lot of signs and wonders. Just deaf ears popped up, saw some people get out of wheelchairs, walk forward, in like the most conservative 8 a.m. service. It was unbelievable what we were experiencing. And I've shared this story a couple of times, but I just always return to it because it's my history with God. And you have to have a history with God in moments like the day of trouble. It's always good to refer back to, oh, I remember when you did this. I remember when you did that. And this was a staple for me in regards to a day of trouble and like facing disappointment. Because there was this, and I'll make this story quick, because I really feel like today as I was praying, I felt like the Lord said he's going to turn the enemy's sword on him and he's going to come after. The Lord is like, vengeance is his. And I feel like he like is really, there's something that's going to sweep through here. I just feel like he's just messed with a number of families and there's just little illnesses and sicknesses. And I just feel like the sword of the Lord's going to come through and really knock some stuff out. I know. Have you guys had our coffee? We are like a millennial hipster church. We have single origin Ethiopian, like ground today, beautiful coffee. Which that helps in the day of trouble too. I mean, it Starbucks doesn't do it, bro. You gotta get the good stuff. Talking to Jerry. So hey, I'm at a Church of Christ. I'm at a Church of Christ, and I can't share this story enough. It really helps process, I think, an eternal perspective of trial, tribulation, what seems like a defeat in the moment, what seems like a setback in the moment, how to process it. So I'm working at the Church of Christ. We're seeing God do some really cool stuff. And we had offices. I had a phone in my office, which is weird to think about having a phone in your office these days. But I had a phone in my office, and the secretary called, and they said, hey, line one's for you, Michael. And I'm like, okay. And I pick it up, and there's a lady on the other line, and she said, hey, my son had a dream last night. And she dreamed that a Church of Christ pastor came to our house, laid hands on our son, and our son got off of his sickbed. I was like, well, what's wrong with your son? Well, the kid was 19 years old, and he had been diagnosed with a form of cancer, terminal form of cancer that was pretty aggressive. And I was like, oh my gosh, why are you on the other line of my phone? Why are you calling me? Well, the son had just had this dream about a Church of Christ pastor, so they called the only Church of Christ that they knew, and the Church of Christ that they called said, we don't have a ministry or we don't have a belief system for this, but we know a Church of Christ church that might. And so they sent him to the Church of Christ. They sent him to the Church of Christ that I worked for. And so this woman, just out of a revelation that her son had, calls this Church of Christ, and the assistant, the admin assistant, you know, up top, there's like two dozen ministers. She's like, who should I give this one to? And so she sent him to me and tells you kind of where I was, you know, I was that guy at the church. And so at the time I see Jay over here, Jay McGee, who's one of my dear friends. I've known him for over 20 years. He's just awesome, good family friend. He's just had such an impact on my family. And Jay was at a Church of Christ too for a while, but we were doing a prayer meeting in Jay's Mexican food restaurant off Knox Henderson. He had a really awesome Mexican restaurant off Knox Henderson. And we were meeting there in the mornings, and actually, I think it was either that day or the next day, we were having a prayer meeting, and I said, hey guys, I got this call. I'd love for y'all to come with me. And so I took Jay, and I think Paul was a part of that, and we went over, and for the first time we met this young boy named Willie. And Willie was, he was, I think, on hospice or about to be. I mean, he was deathly, deathly ill, 19-year-old kid. Park. And so we began to pray for Willie. And I mean, at this point, man, my soul's so anchored in in that God's going to heal this young boy. I mean, it's just the chances of what was happening. Like, faith comes by hearing, and we had heard just the way that process. So we started praying. And man, Willie's numbers started improving tremendously over about a three-month period. I remember it was right when I met Larissa. We went on our first date to a Coldplay concert, and we had to swing by because I wanted to go see Willie. And so Larissa got to pray for him, and he was just like became a friend. He's so lovable and likable. And over the course of that 3 months, he got better, 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 better. And then it took a turn for the worst in like a matter of days. And Willie passed. And it made no sense to me. It made no sense at all. I remember I was so angry at God. I remember we were at a Saturday night service. We had Saturday night church. He died on like a Friday, I believe, Thursday or Friday, because the funeral was on Sunday. And I remember that Saturday night before the funeral, I was so mad at God. Like when the church would stand up, I would sit down. And then when it was time for everyone to sit and engage, I went to the back and I was in the corner. And I told the Lord, I said, "You're cruel to pick me out of the city and send me and to go through this process. I mean, I'm not happy with God." Have you ever been there? Good. And I want you to know it's okay. It's okay. But it's not okay to not take your unhappiness to him, to keep your unhappiness before him. I mean, I was at church, and I had to be there. I was on staff, but I was there, and I probably would have been there anyways. But I was like really being honest with where I was at, and I was honest with friends, and I wasn't just like, well, yeah, I know. Well, I didn't come up with these lame things. I said, "Lord, this is where I'm at. This is where I'm at. I need you to shepherd my heart." And so the next day, it was raining cats and dogs in Dallas. We were on 635 heading to the funeral, which was over off SMU campus at Highland Park Prez, I think, or one of those big churches. And on the way there, I remembered I had a dream the night before. And in the dream, I was playing golf. And golf, to me, the Lord always speaks to all of us through golf, let's be honest. He speaks to me through golf because golf to me is like, it represents life. And so I was playing the Dallas National. And the Dallas National, and some of y'all have heard me share this a number of times, but it's just worth it. I feel like it's a deep revelation for many. I've heard it. This is for you. I was playing golf at the Dallas National, and I played a really good round. Like I remember I was hitting it fairways and greens. I made some birdies, and we were on 18, and I was coming off. And I was like, man, that was a good round. And as I'm walking, Willie, this young boy who had died, came down on a cart, and he got out, and he was extremely healthy. I had never seen him look this way, but he was extremely healthy. He had really long hair, and he smiled, and he gave me this giant hug. And he said that was a great round at the Dallas National, but the guys up in the pro shop, and we looked above on the hill, and the smoke was hitting this window of this pro shop. And he goes, "The guys in the pro shop want to talk to you." So I went to this pro shop, and I'm like looking around, and it's immaculate. Like for me, a golf pro shop's a really big deal. Like the shirts were all lined up, and they had all the new equipment and shoes. And I remember I was just like, "Oh, this is legit." And then the head pro was back there, and he was waiting for me. And I walked up to the head pro, and he goes, "Man, that was a great round at the Dallas National." And I said, "Thanks." He said, "But I want you to know that it's not a typical round. Even though you played it well, it's not a typical round as to how it should go." And I was kind of confused. And he said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "As the head pro, I want to give you two options." And I was like, "Well, what?" He goes, "Well, you can have this." And there was a gift card to get anything in the pro shop that I wanted. Actually, no, it was a gift card for a shirt. It was a gift card for a shirt. You can wear a shirt to remember your round at the Dallas National. Here's a shirt. And then he had another, handed me something else in his other hand, and it was a round to play again. It said another round at the Dallas National. And in my dream, I didn't hesitate. I was like, "I'm playing again." And I grabbed it and I left. And I woke up. And as we're driving to Willie's funeral, I get revelation about this dream. And the dream is this. The dream to me was this, is that the Dallas National in my world is heaven on earth. Like, I don't know of a better place to be than to play the Dallas National. I mean, it is immaculate. You have caddies. It's manicured. There's not, it's just awesome. Do I need to talk more about the Dallas National? It's so good. And so that's heaven on earth. And I had played a round, and Willie was at the end of the round. And heaven on earth, for me, would have been seeing Willie completely healed. And Willie comes to me, and I believe it was an eternal picture of where Willie is, and he points to the pro shop, which are those overseeing heaven on earth. And I went to the head pro, which I think is Jesus, and Jesus is saying, this isn't a typical thing. Meaning, from my perspective, this isn't normal. So you can do one of two things. You can take a shirt and remember that this is just what happens when 19-year-old boys get cancer. You can develop a theology about this that will insulate you. You never have to contend again. You never have to believe again. You never have to go through that. You can shut your heart off, or you can play again. And you can put this in the realm of mystery. You can put this in the realm of mystery, and you can tee it up and believe again with me that I heal cancer. And in that moment, I remember it wasn't like, that's cool revelation, like it's great. That's an amazing sermon. It's an amazing revelation, Michael. That, wow. But for me, it's not a sermon, it's not a revelation. For me, it was an impartation of God's heart to me for that moment that enabled me to cross over, get healing for my heart, get restoration for my heart, to grieve what I was going through. But I knew that one day I would be anchored again. And if a 19-year-old boy shows up with cancer, I'm gonna go about it the same exact way. And I think we have to learn to process what our hearts go through with him, because listen, we live in a fallen, broken world. God is reconciling all things through Christ to him, but it's reconciliation. It's happening still. It's a now reality and a not yet reality. And we live in the tension of King Jesus bringing his kingdom to the earth, and we have been commissioned to fight the good fight of faith. And it's what we hear. It's living, not by sight, not by circumstances, not by feeling, not what I'm going through, but what he has said. I'm gonna fix my eyes on him who shepherds me, who loves me, who nurtures me, who tends to me, who can take whatever I'm going through and bring about goodness, bring about life, bring about his purposes as only he can. But it's not this football like that I just kick up like a, it's not something that I just like punt. What am I trying to say? Why did I start talking about football? It's not, like, I think what we do at times is we chunk it into this realm of his sovereignty, and we disconnect our hearts from really processing what went through it, what it's going through, and allowing him to touch us and to lead us and to minister to us and to speak to us and to direct us specifically through it. Are you following me? Is anything that I'm saying making sense? Like, just like I told you, I'm counseling. But I feel like the Lord wants to resuscitate some hearts. The Bible, it's like, don't let your hearts be troubled. That's in the Old Testament, said a lot, but Paul constantly says, do not lose heart. Do not lose heart. Do not lose heart. And I feel like life comes and it tries to grab hold of our heart and take pieces of it. So before we know it, we're like insulated, broken, and I'm fine. But our hearts are shut off. And what the upper room, there's a lot that's happening upper room, and God's pouring out his presence, we got to overflow, and da 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 da. What we are, we're a people that know how to position our hearts before the presence of Jesus. That when the presence of Jesus comes into this room, it's like the brook of Bezor. I know how to do a cannonball right in the middle of it and splash everyone. Because It's my source. It's my source. It's my source. My paycheck isn't. My marriage isn't. My family isn't. My ministry isn't. Like, the presence of God is my source. It's my source. It's not goosebumps. It's not these guys up here singing, although that helps, but it is my source, man. The vision of this church isn't for you, it's for me. It's like, I knew if I'm called to lead. What am I called to lead? I'm called to lead something that I'm desperate for. I love principles, I love teaching, I love sermons, I love all that undergirds that. That. Some of us are so disconnected from our feeler and our emotions, and like we don't even know where our heart is. And this has the ability to awaken our hearts again and to open our hearts again and to heal our hearts and to bring wholeness to our hearts and to bring connection again to life, to our spouses, to our friends. Has this ability to, oh, that's the real me. Connecting to the real you, connecting to the real him. It's beyond my head. It's beyond what I say. It's truly like walking with Jesus. That's my sermon.
Thank you for listening to this message. For more information about the Upper Room, please visit europe.org.